From the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. It's Monday, March 2nd, 2015. As the news of yet another police killing, this time of a mentally ill homeless man on Skid Row, comes to light, we'll have an in-depth conversation with former LAPD officer Cheryl Dorsey. And Venezuela slaps travel restrictions on Americans and reduces the U.S. Embassy staff. In the latest on U.S.-Venezuela tensions, we'll speak with Professor Miguel Tinker Salas. That's coming up today after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Rahul Mahajan. He's a sociologist and author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. Hi, Rahul.
Hi, Sonali.
The Iraqi National Army has launched a major offensive on the Islamic State in an effort to retake the key city of Tikrit. According to AP, Iraqi forces are, quote, backed by allied Shiite, Sunni and Iranian fighters and are apparently approaching the ISIS-held region from a number of directions simultaneously, including from the air. Tikrit is only 80 miles north of the capital Baghdad and one of the largest cities to be held by ISIS. It is well known for being Saddam Hussein's hometown. Meanwhile, ISIS rebels have a new target in sight, Twitter. The group has singled out Twitter co-founder Jack Dorsey with threats over the company's constant disabling of ISIS accounts, especially those that announce beheadings. A threat posted by ISIS against Dorsey on Sunday read, quote, "Your virtual war on the internet will cause a real war on you." As per Twitter rules, users, quote, may not publish or post direct specific threats of violence against others or use the social media service for, quote, any unlawful purposes or in furtherance of illegal activities. Well, Rahul, on the ISIS war on the ground, how do you assess the success so far to combat ISIS, and can Iraqi forces succeed?
Well, you know, I think that the story with regard to the war against ISIS is a very familiar one to us. I mean, I think that the reason that things are different now than they were in, say, 2004, 2005, or 2006 is that there were 150,000 plus American troops on the ground occupying Iraq at the time, and there was then and is now no force that can sort of stand up to and challenge that out in the open. They have to resort as they did to guerrilla hit and run tactics. So where the United States has intervened heavily, like in the assault on Kobani, ISIS has been thwarted. Elsewhere, it has mostly been not been thwarted, with the exception of, you know, any advance on Baghdad, where that's a city where if ISIS took it, that would cause more troubles for them than it would be a triumph. I think the same is true of Tikrit in the opposite sense, which is to say that the Shiite-dominated Iraqi force may well be able to take Tikrit back from ISIS.
And U.S. and Iranian officials are continuing high-level talks in Geneva today in an effort to hammer out an agreement that will satisfy U.S. fears of a nuclear program and Iran's desire to end sanctions. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has personally invested much in talks with his counterpart, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, in a relationship that has angered most prominently Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu last week openly admitted that he would, quote, "do everything that I can to prevent this agreement," and has just arrived in the U.S. for a controversial two-day visit. Before he addresses Congress tomorrow, Netanyahu will speak to the powerful pro-Israel lobby group AIPAC today. He was invited to the U.S. by the GOP in a direct snub of President Obama and his commitment to an agreement with Iran. Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein over the weekend surprised many by accusing Netanyahu of arrogance in claiming to speak for all Jews. Still, she plans to attend his speech tomorrow. Rahul, can Israel thwart a U.S.-Iran deal?
Well, I mean, let's consider two different things. At this point, I think that Obama and Netanyahu are so much on the outs, and Obama is so unconcerned with Republican opposition or even with the opposition of Democratic hawks that I don't think domestic developments are going to thwart the ability of Obama's team to come up with some sort of agreement on paper with Iran. But we should also remember that the U.S. Senate kind of got out of the treaty ratifying business sometime in the mid to late 90s, with the exception of the occasional small-scale free trade agreement. And there's no way that Obama is going to get it back into that business with a 54-seat Republican majority. So this is going to remain only at the level of executive agreements.
And finally, in a day heavy on international news, Secretary Kerry has also met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov during his visit to Geneva, hoping to push Russia to honor a two-week-old ceasefire agreement with Ukraine. But the situation remains grim, with hundreds of deaths occurring in the past 2 weeks alone, particularly in the strategically important areas of Donetsk and Debaltseve in Ukraine. In fact, the United Nations announced this morning that more than 6,000 people have died since the conflict began in the summer of 2014. Inside Russia, the Putin regime faces a serious test, with tens of thousands of people marching in Moscow yesterday to denounce the death of a prominent government critic, Boris Nemtsov. Nemtsov was killed outside the Kremlin on Friday night in a drive-by shooting. He was a well-known adversary of President Vladimir Putin. Well, Rahul, between the Ukraine conflict and the attacks on dissidents, is Russia in crisis?
Well, I think that there are a number of sort of indications of Russia, of first of all, of Russia as a country being in crisis, and second, of whatever pathetic remnants of liberal democracy are there being in crisis. So with the first, the Ukraine war, the crackdowns on dissidents, those are certainly indications. I think probably a bigger story for Russia right now is the precipitous drop in the world market price of oil, even though it's made a somewhat of a recovery in the past month. That's going to heavily impact an economy that is based almost entirely on extractive industries and export. In terms of liberal democracy, I would also add to that catalog the growing sort of nexus between the state and the Orthodox Church, almost sort of a revival of the situation under Tsarism.
Well, Rahul Mahajan, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you again next week.
See you then.
Rahul Mahajan is a sociologist and author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. This is Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. You can now watch Uprising on Free Speech TV, which airs on Dish Network Channel 9415, DirecTV Channel 348, and on hundreds of part-time cable affiliates and on Roku. The Los Angeles Police Department is under fire once more for the killing of an unarmed man. A violent encounter on Skid Row in downtown L.A. yesterday between four officers and a mentally ill homeless man, identified only by his nickname Africa, resulted in five shots from three of the officers. Video of the encounter from a bystander was posted online and has already been viewed more than 6 million times. Here's a clip of that video for our TV audience. Please be warned, it is graphic. And that is a video clip from a video that was taken by a bystander yesterday in an incident where an unarmed, mentally ill homeless man was killed by LAPD. And a mistrial was declared last week in the fatal beating of a black woman named Alicia Thomas in Los Angeles. LAPD officer Mary O'Callaghan pleaded not guilty to assault charges for her role in kicking Thomas, who was handcuffed 7 times in the groin, abdomen and upper thigh. Thomas lost consciousness and died in a hospital room. Cases of police beatings and killings are so common these days that not a week passes by when a story doesn't break from somewhere in the nation of an incident involving brutality and violence under the color of the law. The situation has reached such epidemic levels that now a group of retired police officers are lobbying Congress for change in the way policing is done. The National Coalition of Law Enforcement Officers for Justice, Reform and Accountability traveled to Washington, D.C. last week to meet with lawmakers. One of them now joins me in studio. Cheryl Dorsey is a retired LAPD sergeant. She's been on the force since 1980. She is the author of The Creation of a Manifesto, Black and Blue. Welcome to Uprising, Cheryl.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's talk about this shooting yesterday on Skid Row. The LAPD said, quote, "It's clear there was a struggle for the officer's gun." I mean, it amazes me how often unarmed people seem to want to lunge towards the guns of armed police who are trained to kill anyone who does such a thing. And honestly, I don't buy it. And I think a lot of people aren't buying the same excuse that's trotted out over and over again. He lunged for my gun. He was grabbing for my gun, so I had to shoot him. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, in this instance, we have the video and we do see that there was an altercation between the mentally ill man and the police. And so this is a little different than some of the other stories that we've heard. And understand that police officers are given great deference, right? So as an authority figure, when we say a thing, people want to believe that what we're saying is truthful. Now, I don't know if the young man was going for the officer's gun. We hear the officer repeatedly saying, "Put the gun down, put the gun down." My hope is that he's being honest in that cry for him to put it down, and that wasn't something that was manufactured for the use of the deadly force that we see on video.
Now, how do you, as a retired police officer, explain this epidemic of police violence in the U.S.? And is it just something new? Are we just seeing more of it now? Because more and more people have the ability to document these things ourselves with the advent of digital technology. And I should say, by the way, tomorrow is the 14th anniversary of the police beating of Rodney King in L.A., which was one of the first such incidences.
Well, you know, these things are not new. This has been going on for some time. We know that. Rodney King happened in the 90s, right?
Yeah.
I think we're seeing more of it now because of the advent of cell phones and video recordings, and so people in a moment's notice can pull out something and memorialize the event. But what I think happens is I think that sometimes officers become personally involved in a situation. And I think when you become personally involved, I think you're able to lose your humanity. And I think that what we've seen across the nation is what I call contempt of cop. And that is, if I'm a police officer and I give you an order and you don't follow it, you make me mad, there's a price to pay. That price could be a traffic ticket. That price could be I could put you in jail on a Friday and you can't bail out and you spend the weekend in jail. On Monday, it's a district attorney reject because there was insufficient probable cause to arrest you. Or you could pay the ultimate price, and that's with your life, as in the case of Eric Garner, when he didn't do what that officer told him to do, which was turn around. As in the case of Mike Brown, when he didn't get out of the street like Darren Wilson told him to. Here in Los Angeles, we have Ezell Ford, who LAPD wanted to talk with him about what I don't know, and he didn't want to talk. He didn't stop. They grabbed him, and then they created a situation to use deadly force.
Well, let's talk also about the case of Alicia Thomas. In this case, we see an issue that is also raised constantly. The fact that Alicia Thomas was a drug user was raised to justify her killing. That was raised in Michael Brown, when even Trayvon Martin, although that was not a police killing, those sorts of issues are raised that we tend to constantly indict victims after they're dead rather than the police perpetrators. You know, and also not just the drug use. Eric Garner died because he was overweight, etc. So, and Michael Brown was a thief, apparently. And Alicia Thomas was a cocaine user, so she deserved to die. And how do you respond to that when we are sort of killing these victims a second time around after they're dead?
Well, you know, it's easy to try to minimize and mitigate the bad behavior, right? If we devalue that person, if we make them so undesirable in the eye of the public, then it's easier to justify this thing that happened to them, this killing, right? And so I understand that, you know, police chiefs like ours here in L.A. Has a responsibility to the police department first, and if the officer benefits, oh well. And so, you know, they never admit wrongdoing. And I don't understand why, if you really want to change things, if you really want to engender the trust of the community, it might be in your best interest, Chief Beck, to every now and again say, maybe we could have done something differently, because no one gets it right 100% of the time. And so if we don't admit that there's a problem, then how do we even begin to change that thing that they say is not broken?
So one of the solutions that have been offered by police and embraced to an extent by police are body-worn cameras. And there are, of course, cameras on the dashboards of police vehicles. In the case of Alicia Thomas, that footage of this woman being kicked by a female officer was actually kept from jurors because they thought it would, quote, potentially taint the opinion of the jurors. But, I mean, isn't that evidence? How do you respond to this one potential so-called solution that if only we had more cameras, then we wouldn't see this kind of violence?
Well, for me personally, video cameras bring me no comfort, right? Mm-hmm. Because we have so many instances and examples of things that have been documented and memorialized on video, yet we have grand juries who, seeing those video images, still find in the officers' behalf, because again, great deference is given to police officers. And so video, no video, unless and until we get the public, I think, to understand that sometimes police officers are dishonest by happenstance or just because they're dishonest. Unless and until we get people who become members of grand juries to understand that sometimes police officers don't have the training that's necessary to do the job. And sometimes we have police officers who really are just unsuited for the position. Mm-hmm. And so if a citizen in the community, if a juror member doesn't buy into that, then whether it's memorialized on video or not, as in Eric Garner, we see them choking him with a prohibited hold, as in Tamir Rice, the baby that was killed in Cleveland. You know, we see the officers use poor tactics when they approach him and they shoot him within seconds of driving up. So video, body-worn, civilian recordings, they don't bring me any comfort.
So then ultimately, I think what you just brought up earlier, which is the dehumanization of people, is part of the problem. The dehumanization of black and brown people, of poor people, of homeless people, of mentally ill people. And that's a cultural discussion as well. So tell us about what happened last week. You were in Washington, D.C. Who accompanied you? Who did you speak with? What sorts of conversations did you have? And does Congress really realize what a problem this is?
I think they do. We had an opportunity to meet with Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, and she is on the House Judiciary Committee. And she is putting forth a bill right now, H.R. 59, that's going to work towards building trust between the community and the police department, and it's called the Build Trust Act. And in doing that, she's very excited about working with our group, and we are a group of retired and former police officers from across the nation. We come from Los Angeles, St. Louis, New York, East Orange, New Jersey, Philadelphia, and even we have a tenured, retired U.S. Marshal who is amongst us. And so we're just validating and corroborating what the public already knows. We're not saying anything that's new and different. We're agreeing that the system is broken. We're agreeing that there's institutionalized racism. We're in agreement that there's state-sponsored murder going on right now. And we're just saying it from a position of law enforcement. So when we say it, no one in the law enforcement community that heads that department can say, you didn't get it right.
Or you're anti-police or whatever.
Well, they may say we're anti-police, right?
But you're former police.
But you know, what I say is I love the police. I spent 20 years of my life on the Los Angeles Police Department. And so I don't say what I say because I'm anti-police. I say what I say because I really want there to be a difference. I really want there to be a change in the way police departments interact with the community. I'm a mother. I have four sons. And so that's always in the forefront of my mind when I speak. This could be my son.
Right. Now, there was a major story that broke in Chicago in the last week, about this place in Chicago called Homan Square, operated by Chicago police, that the journalist in question referred to as akin to a CIA black site. Chicagoans who've been arrested have been taken there, zip-tied for hours without access to lawyers, tortured, abused, and beaten. People are constantly, you know, having their constitutional rights violated, and the building in question is the site of the sort of anti-gang, anti-drug task forces of the police department. Were you shocked to hear the story that people were just being disappeared here?
Well, you know, nothing surprises me. And I've heard and seen some things during my 20 years on LAPD that one would think if I had not been a part of that during that time, I would think there's no way. You know, we had the Rampart scandal where we had officers who were shooting gang members, and I would think that a police officer would never do that. And so it doesn't surprise me. And unless and until there's a consequence for that bad behavior, as long as police officers can hide behind the police department, as long as police heads can say, I'm not going to discuss this bad behavior because it's a personnel matter and it's confidential, we have to change the police officers' Bill of Rights, which allows them to shield police, which allows the police officer to suffer no real consequence. If police officers had to pay financial restitution when someone is injured or killed, I think this thing would stop yesterday.
It seems as though no one's off limits either. You know, in just the last few weeks, we heard the case of the elderly Indian man who was brutally beaten for just walking in his son's neighborhood in Alabama, in a suburb. Then it should be noted that a neighbor called the cops because they thought he was a black man.
Right.
Then last year in Fresno, California, an 80-year-old grandmother dropping off baked goods for her granddaughters at her school was pepper sprayed by an officer, dislocated her shoulder. I mean, cops are beating grandmas, grandfathers. Why? What is wrong? I mean, why are they taking... You said it can become personal, so there's a sort of revenge attitude. I mean, these are elderly folks.
I think, you know, a lot of it has to do with common sense, right? Because I always say if sense was common, everyone would have it. And so you can't teach common sense. You can't read that in a book. That's got to be in your gut. That's got to be part of who you are, right? Caring about people. You can't teach a person to have empathy and compassion
for someone. But they're
supposed
to be protecting and serving
us. Absolutely. And that's why you have to understand that not everybody who puts on a uniform is really fit to wear that uniform. And so the background checks need to be more vigorous. And I believe that there should be a reevaluation, a psychological reevaluation. And I just say every 3 months, because I believe as a police officer, every 3 years.
Okay.
Because as a police officer, when you're exposed to certain things day in and day out, it's very easy to become jaded if you're not careful. If you're partnered with someone who's accustomed to stepping over the line and you want to please that person because he's your training officer or because he's your partner and you guys have worked together for 6 or 7 years, I think the department needs to take your temperature and sit you down and have a conversation with you intermittently and just make sure that your head is on straight. And if the department sees that it's not, then take the affirmative action to get that person off the streets, get them the help that they need, or help them find another job.
Cheryl Dorsey, so many of the arrests around the country are drug-related, and yet the climate in the country around drug use, particularly marijuana use, is of course changing. But just in terms of how people are disproportionately arrested, white Americans, much more likely than black Americans to have used most kinds of illegal drugs, including cocaine, marijuana, and LSD, yet blacks are far more likely to go to prison for drug offenses. They're arrested more than 3 times as often as whites, and it's of course police officers doing the arrests. I mean, if I was a police officer and I knew that whites were using more drugs, I might go to a white community and do, you know, if I thought racial profiling was even an ethical thing to do. Why aren't they going after white users?
Well, you have to understand, I mean, here in Los Angeles, we do have 2 police departments, right? We have officers who police the community one way south of the Santa Monica Freeway, because that's kind of the dividing line between South Central Los Angeles and some of the more affluent areas over in West Los Angeles and Hollywood and Beverly Hills, right? So we do have 2 police departments, and I think most police departments work that way. You treat the people in the socioeconomic low-income areas one way, because typically they don't complain. I always say you should create a paper trail and write a letter of complaint if you feel like you have been treated in a way that's not appropriate or your rights have been violated. And then we have the way officers police themselves in West LA. You know, certainly the things that are tolerated in 77th Division here in Los Angeles or in Southeast Division, which is South Central Los Angeles, would never be tolerated in West LA. You could not do that in Pacific Division.
Because you know that the wealthier, whiter folks would lawyer up, basically.
Well, they'll complain. They'll call the station. And in those areas, you know, a lot of them are on a first name basis with the captain. They have his number. And so they'll call and they'll complain. Minorities don't do that. And we need to do more of it. If for no other reason, just to create that paper trail and show that this officer is behaving in a way that's inappropriate. It may not benefit you, but after 3 or 4 or 5 complaints, someone, my hope would be, would have to say, maybe where there's smoke, there's fire.
Now, of course, pot is slowly becoming legal around the nation. Washington, D.C., where you just were, under certain restrictions, you can be a legal pot user, and it's turning into a big business. Michelle Alexander says, white men get rich from legal pot while black men stay in prison. And I'm wondering, are police attitudes changing around this as pot is becoming legal, at least on the issue of that one drug?
Well, you know, I think officers certainly are going to do what they're told to do, right? And I mean, we even now, we have police officers who were drug users. There was a time when I came on, if you were an admitted marijuana user, you were disqualified. And so, you know, officers need to understand that although they come from society and they come with their own biases and their predisposed decisions about people, they need to understand and treat people as if this could be your family member.
Yeah.
That could be your mom. It could be your sister. It could be your brother. And I think when you lose your humanity, it's difficult for you to act in a way that's appropriate.
Hmm. So on the issue of how policing needs to change, some people have often brought up the fact that when police hail from the community that they police, they, of course, are more likely to see the people that they police as their own neighbors and friends because they're more likely to be their neighbors and friends. Is that part of a vision of better policing that you espouse?
Well, you know, here in Los Angeles, we have community-based policing, right? And
mm-hmm.
I think it works fairly well. I don't know that officers necessarily need to live in the area where they work because that brings a whole nother set of issues. If you're in the grocery store and you see somebody that you had an interaction with, it could go bad, right? And you're with your family. But I think if officers get to know the community. There was an incident not too long ago where, I think it was in Alabama, a police officer was called to a store where a grandmother had stolen some eggs. And he knew this lady and he knew her situation and he felt compassion for her. And rather than arrest her, he went and bought her a dozen eggs. She was stealing 2 or 3. And he did that and he said, because I know her and I'm familiar with her situation. And so I think if officers around the nation would get to know the community, just get to know them, spend some time with them, you know, go to community meetings, have a real engagement. And then I think you can see them as a human being as opposed to a statistic.
Now, Cheryl Dorsey, going back to the issue of the role of the federal government and the power that Congress may have, FBI Director James Comey has publicly come out and talked about this problem with police violence. One of the things he's addressed that many people have brought up as an issue is that there's no requirement anymore for there to be a federal database of police killings, and hopefully that will change. But the other part that the federal government bears responsibility for is literally arming police departments with the weapons of war and the militarization of police departments, giving them surplus weapons that are meant for the battlefields of Iraq. Is that an issue that's being addressed? And how troubled are you by it?
Well, I'm certainly bothered by the militarization of police departments. And I think we're going to have legislation on a federal level that will address this problem for police departments state to state, right? Because otherwise you'll have a disparity in terms of how police agencies move and act with the community. And I think my hope is that we will have legislation, and that's why we're excited to talk to Sheila Jackson Lee about the kinds of things that we think are common sense proposals. Certainly there needs to be reform. There definitely needs to be accountability. That's what we hear from the victim families, is they want someone to be accountable for this thing that was done.
I mean, that's an issue. I mean, time and again, cops, if they're even indicted, are almost never convicted. And there's this major, major lack of trust. What are your thoughts on what you saw unfolding in Ferguson last year, which I'm, you know, assuming is a big part of what has prompted you and your fellow retired officers to speak out? And also, what sort of conversations have you had with the folks involved in the Black Lives Matter movement? Because there is a distrust of police. Some of that might extend to retired police.
Right. You know, they are very distrustful, and I understand. And it's going to take time for them to accept us wholeheartedly as well. But I think, you know, as we deal with them on an individual basis, the families that we've talked to have been very receptive. I've personally had conversations with Patrice Coulars, who's the co-founder of Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, was a guest here on our show.
We've had the family of Oscar Grant in Oakland, California with us in D.C. And so accountability, that's what the families want. And if we can help them get that, I think that will be a good place to start.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Cheryl Dorsey, for joining us today, and best of luck to you.
Thank you. I appreciate you for having me.
My guest is Cheryl Dorsey, retired LAPD sergeant. She was on the force of the Los Angeles Police Department since 1980, was on there for 20 years. She's the author of The Creation of a Manifesto, Black and Blue. We turn now to Mumia Abu-Jamal, a political prisoner and award-winning journalist. He filed this commentary on Black History Month, which just ended.
Obama and Black History Month, 2015. As the Obama administration winds down, what is its relationship to Black History Month, 2015? Of course, the election of an African American was indeed an historic event, and history books will well record this fact. But it was also an attempt by the Democratic Party to lock in a constituency that would fuel its political ascendancy for generations. In symbol, the election of President Barack Obama was a shock to the system. In substance, it was a lot less so. For beside this symbol stood a reality that black life was under siege. In 2014, summer broke with black protests from coast to coast, led by youth, young people who knew in their heart of hearts that the White House could not protect them from a peculiar American practice of police terrorism. When cops could harass, intimidate, beat, choke, kick, stomp, and kill kids, boys, and men with perfect impunity. Symbol, shining and bright, met substance of blood and tears, and one shattered the other. Tens of thousands stormed the streets in over 200 cities to howl at injustice, and to demand now, finally, justice. For them, Ferguson became their Selma, and they faced guns and automatic weapons with courage and fury. Symbols are powerful things, yes, but reality is more powerful still. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. You can now subscribe for direct access to all our shows online at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Your subscription sustains the TV production of Uprising. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro over the weekend announced a reduction in the staff of the U.S. Embassy and new travel restrictions for Americans to Venezuela. The government also released a number of U.S. missionaries who had been detained and allowed them to return home. The moves are part of a new crisis emerging in Venezuela over the past 2 weeks, centered on government allegations of a new coup attempt labeled the Blue Coup. Authorities acting on orders of Venezuelan President Maduro arrested Caracas Mayor Antonio Ledezma in mid-February. Ledezma will face trial for conspiracy against the government, and as a longtime right-wing politician and prominent member of the Venezuelan opposition, which last year mobilized thousands of people in street protests, resulting in the killing of 43 people. He's being held in the same facility as another right-wing politician arrested last year, Leopoldo Lopez, for overseeing a plan called La Salida, or the exit, to overturn the Maduro government. Maduro took over from the late Hugo Chavez, a charismatic figure who ushered in Venezuela's current socialist government. New protests in the wake of Ledesma's arrest are once more threatening to destabilize Venezuela. A 14-year-old boy named Cluivert Roa was killed after being shot with rubber bullets by government police at a demonstration in San Cristobal last week. Mainstream publications in the U.S. are reporting the news with glee, with The Economist's coverage contending that, quote, Venezuela's Bolivarian regime is lurching from authoritarianism to dictatorship. My guest is Miguel Tinker Salas. He's a professor of Latin American history and Chicano Latino studies at Pomona College in Claremont, California. He's written several books, including The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Citizenship in Venezuela, and Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know. He co-edited Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, and the Decline of an Exceptional Democracy. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us, Miguel. So the New York Times last week published this editorial whose opening lines were, quote, listening to embattled President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela ramble on for hours about an international right-wing conspiracy to oust him, it's clear that he would use any fabricated pretext to jail opposition leaders and crack down on dissent. In recent days, the government's claims have become outlandish and its repression of critics even more vicious. Miguel, was this just a fabricated conspiracy? What evidence is there that Ledesma and others were involved in a coup attempt?
We know that there has been a constant effort at destabilizing Venezuelan government and society and politics. We know that there was a historical amnesia on the part of the New York Times that celebrated the 2002 coup against Hugo Chavez. And this is a newspaper that historically has taken a very, very strident position against Venezuela. So while 43 people were killed in protests last year on both sides of the political spectrum, including police and National Guardsmen, the New York Times blames the government for these deaths, even though they occurred on both sides of the political spectrum, and yet they remain silent about the 43 students that were killed in Mexico. So again, they have a very clear position on the issue of Venezuela. So on Mexico, where there's 100,000 dead and a real humanitarian crisis, they say almost nothing. And on Venezuela, they constantly pressure Venezuela and highlight issues of Venezuela simply to mock the government. So in other words, absence of toilet paper, absence of toothpaste or condoms, or other issues are used to mock the government, when in other countries like Mexico, which are U.S. allies, people don't even have access to basic services and food. So I think we have to be clear as to what the objective of the New York Times is. Now, obviously, in the question of coups, we have evidence now, at least the government has provided evidence, that there was individuals in the military discussing. They provided evidence last week, last Thursday, of an individual in the military that now said that he was approached by others to destabilize the government and to stage a coup. Now, I would really urge the government to publicize this, to make this very transparent, so that people can actually see, and we can avoid these kind of issues about whether the government is overreacting or not.
Now, I understand that Ledesma and a number of other opposition leaders, some of whom are jailed, signed onto a public letter called a National Transition Agreement. VenezuelaAnalysis.com, which is one of the few sources that seem to be unbiased, is reporting that there's evidence that Ledesma made several calls to a U.S. number and that a cache of weapons was discovered in the party headquarters of the opposition in Caracas. I mean, that, at least on the surface, sounds pretty serious.
Well, the issue here is that, as you said in the very introductory piece, there has been an ongoing effort. Last year, during the same exact period of time, in February and March, there was a proposal called La Salida, the exit, in a democratic society where people should abide by the democratic process. It's unbelievable that they would actually try to overthrow a democratically elected government while at the same time claiming to be Democrats and have the mantle of democracy. So in that sense, it's very problematic. This time, they shifted taxes and tactics and now call it la transición, or the transition. Imagine if tomorrow the Republicans put out a document in the U.S. that said we now have a process to go for a transition to replace Obama before there's an election now, mind you, but we're still going to adopt the mantle or proclaim the mantle of being Democrats in this process. We're going to engage in efforts at destabilizing. We're going to try to approach the military. We're going to essentially hoard products or halt production. We're going to follow the model that was applied in Chile against Salvador Allende in 1972 and 1973, yet we're going to proclaim to be Democrats. And this is the irony and the sad truth about what confronts Venezuela.
Small D Democrats, I'm assuming you meant. Earlier this year, President Obama, and let's talk about what is emerging from the U.S., President Obama unveiled his national security strategy and said Venezuela was a threat. He said that he stressed support for Venezuelan citizens living in a country where, quote, democracy is at risk. Vice President Joe Biden reportedly hosted a Caribbean Energy Summit last month where he met with other Latin American leaders, and Maduro is saying that Biden told these other leaders privately to isolate Venezuela. He took that as a U.S. meddling in Venezuelan affairs. All of this is also fairly incriminating, and yet President Obama and the State Department have said they have nothing to do with any kind of coup attempt.
Well, it's ironic, as you point out, that the U.S. under Bush adopted a policy of trying to isolate Venezuela much the same way. They referred to Venezuela as having a contagion that had to be isolated from the rest of the region. That is, they wanted to inoculate Latin America from Venezuela. And here we have now the Obama administration essentially continuing exactly the same policy with regards to Latin America in general and Venezuela in particular. And particularly what they are concerned about is that Venezuela, through the use of Petrocaribe and of a very direct diplomacy in the region, has displaced the U.S. in the Caribbean and in large parts of Central America. And so here's a double-edged sword they try to use. On the one hand, Venezuela has provided oil, not at discounted prices, but oil at long-term credit rates to the regions of Latin America. Therefore, they are all part of Petrocaribe, as well as part of the Union of South America, the CELAC, the Community of Latin American and South American Nations, so that they have really shifted away from dependence on the U.S., dependence on the OAS, and moved into a much more arena of inter-regional arrangements and solidarity. And that's what troubles the U.S., and in which Venezuela is playing a key role. And I think that's what really troubles Biden and also the Obama administration. And therefore, they've talked about launching a new Caribbean initiative, much the same way Reagan did previously or Bush did also. But the reality is that they really don't want to engage with the region on an equal basis. And that's the difference that Venezuela has and other countries.
So they're worried, you're saying, about the influence of Venezuela in the region. And of course, the U.S. has been trying to pick off allies and create allies in the continent and the region, Latin America in general, of course, historically. Let's talk about, I just want to quote what the State Department said in response to Maduro's claim. It released a statement, you know, some of which you could say are debatable and arguable, but one sentence in particular stood out to me. It said, the allegations made by the Venezuelan government that the United States is involved in coup plotting and destabilization are baseless and false. Fine, you can argue that. But then it goes on to say, the United States does not support political transitions by non-constitutional means. I mean, that's a flat-out lie. It's done.
Well, not only is it a flat-out lie, again, I want to urge that, suggest that they have historical amnesia. Here we have coups that go back throughout the 20th century that in which the U.S. has been involved and in which U.S. presidents have recently actually apologized for in the case of Guatemala, in the case of Chile. So that it's an irony that they want to now create again the notion that somehow they're not involved when we know for a fact that they were involved in 2002. We have an incident that's very almost hilarious. At a meeting of military attachés, a U.S. military attaché walks up to a Venezuelan general and mistakenly, he mistaken the individual as someone he was having a contact with and said, how come you haven't called me? I have the materials ready for you. He mistaken and talked to someone that was actually pro-government. Huh. And that's how come we know the information. So for them to say that they're not having been doing this is absurd. And it really goes against the historical record.
Now, last year, as the opposition protest became very big, the social media campaign by the opposition reached here in the United States. There were major protests in the street, and Leopoldo Lopez, one of the main opposition leaders, was arrested, remains arrested for being part of this coup attempt from last year that we talked about, La Salida. And he has organized with groups that we know directly receive funding from U.S. agencies like the National Endowment for Democracy and USAID. Is there any, those are pretty problematic groups in general for fueling coup attempts around the world and so-called transitions around the world. And do you have any sense that their involvement continues in Venezuela? I mean, the Venezuelan government would be in its right to bar groups that receive this funding if those groups have had coup attempts.
Well, this is the critical point here. People are so accustomed, it's been so naturalized that the U.S., through its various so-called democratic endowment organizations, whether the National Endowment for Democracy, the Democratic Party Endowment for Democracy, the Republican Party Endowment for Democracy, USAID, or including the AFL-CIO, which at one point was also providing funds, people would come to the right-wing rallies, the opposition rallies. They had the best sound system. The stages were already set up. Of course, they were getting funds for all this, and they have been receiving funds for all this in order to destabilize. But I want to underscore something here. In terms of the social media and the issues last year, it's really ironic that all these Hollywood types all came out to condemn Venezuela, support human rights theoretically, yet on Mexico, they've been silent. I really do think that this is really an interesting issue. Look at the last Oscars, in which last year, during that time, actors and actresses made comments about Venezuela, human rights, and yet on Mexico, they're silent. So again, it's very kind of biased notion of where democracy exists and where it doesn't and how it's constructed. But again, that's what the role of the mainstream media has been, to create that matriz de opinión, or that notion of dominant view here in terms of how Venezuela is portrayed, how it's projected, and how it's incorporated into this discourse of democracy in the U.S., when in reality, it doesn't have that function in Latin America, where it has a much different role as an advocate of regional integration and of social policy.
Let's talk about the death of the 14-year-old boy, Cluiver Torroa, who was apparently killed by rubber bullets during an opposition demonstration just days before that happened. The government had apparently passed new regulations allowing soldiers to open fire if they feel their lives are at risk during demonstrations. Now, I do understand that the police officer in question has been arrested. The government has denounced the killing and not defended it. But are you troubled, or is there, should we worry about the role of the government police in these demonstrations?
Well, I think that under no circumstance should protests be criminalized. And I think that it was a tragic accident that happened in the death of this individual. It wasn't a case in which the police was simply targeting individuals. It's important to underscore, if the military is being unleashed on the population, we would not be seeing numbers in the range of 42, 43, as we did last year. We'd be seeing it in the range of thousands, as we've seen in the case of Mexico. So I think it's a tragic incident. Protests should not be criminalized under any circumstance. The individual has been arrested. There should be transparency in his trial and in having clear policies regarding permitting protests. But also, protests cannot be used as an excuse for violence, because we know that those protests have in fact been used in order to destabilize the government. Examples of that is to block freeways, to block highways. Those things would not be accepted in the U.S. I always tell my students, imagine if you decided to go outside tomorrow and block the 10 freeway. You'd be arrested. But that's precisely what happens in Venezuela under the guise of being a democracy. And again, that's a double discourse that we see in how Venezuela is represented.
And last year, there were reports that were pretty well documented of right-wing protesters pulling cable wire across freeways or streets so that people riding motorcycles, many of whom were government supporters, would be hurt. And one person, I understand, was even killed by this, drove right into it and it almost severed his head.
They did. They were decapitated. I saw. I was there in Venezuela at the time. I saw the cables myself. I have photographs of the cables. A person was decapitated in Mérida. A person was decapitated in Caracas. There was a general actually telling people, a former military general, retired, belonging to the opposition, telling people where to how to hang the wire, how high to hang the wire, so that in order to have the most effect on people with motorcycles, because they want to criminalize the poor. They want to criminalize those who ride motorcycles because they tend to be poor and support the government. I saw it with my own eyes. They also put them at the level of your ankle, so you wouldn't see them below your feet and actually trip and fall onto glass and rocks and nails.
Let's talk about Venezuela's economic issues. Obviously, plummeting oil prices have had a serious impact on economies around the world. We talked about Russia earlier in our program, but Venezuela, of course, being an oil-based economy, is certainly suffering. the government's job, of course, is that much harder. And you had mentioned earlier how the media here in the U.S. and Western media in general tend to mock the Venezuelan government. The Economist wrote, quote, crackpot economic policies have brought food shortages, soaring inflation and rising poverty. What is The Economist talking about here? What sort of crackpot economic policies are they talking about?
Well, the crackpot economic policies is that 60% of the budget actually goes to social programs, and they would rather it to go to infrastructure in the oil company so they can produce more oil, so they can have a larger supply of oil on the world market.
And also have privately owned oil.
And privately owned, because that's the position of the opposition, is to return the oil company, PDVSA, back to private hands and not to have social programs. Undoubtedly, Venezuela is having an economic crisis. When oil was at $90 a barrel and now dropped to below 50, that has really contracted the economy. The economy depends wholly on oil. And even though they have reduced imports by something like 33%, 34%, they're still very much wholly dependent on oil and on the import of products to fulfill increasing demand. The first thing to keep in mind is that Venezuela has seen dramatic increase in demand as the resources have now reached poorer sectors who can now consume. So there's greater and greater demand on the infrastructure to supply products to the Venezuelan population. But primarily what the economists and others are referring to in terms of crackpot economics is essentially social policy aimed at alleviating poverty. Undoubtedly, poverty has increased given the current economic crisis, and that's a tragedy that the government must address. But to suggest that somehow because you have social programs that's crackpot economics, I think is simply absurd. And again, let me highlight the example of what happens in a country like Mexico, where 50% of the population live in poverty and is portrayed as a model for Western development and neoliberal economics.
Miguel Tinker Salas, many in the media are also alleging that the upcoming elections in Venezuela later this year is one of the reasons why Maduro is claiming coup attempts and arresting opposition leaders so that they can't run for election. Again, The Economist, just because it really exemplifies Western media coverage, said Mr. Maduro exceeds his former boss. Chavez let rivals challenge him in a free-ish vote. Mr. Maduro locks them up. How do you respond? I'm not sure if The Economist ever really had pro-Chavez coverage.
Well, the interesting thing is that the elections are actually for the National Assembly. So right. Arresting a former mayor of Caracas is not in one way or another going to affect the impact of what essentially are local elections. And neither is an effort to say that there was a coup or not a coup is not going to affect the result of local elections. People are going to vote their interests, and their interests are going to be represented by people who defend them. And that's essentially what's going to happen here. So the very notion that by arresting Mr. Ledesma, somehow that's going to alter the effects of a national assembly election is simply absurd.
So, Miguel, the media coverage in the U.S. on Venezuela is so biased that it just really makes me wonder. I mean, even an issue as controversial as, say, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you see, I think, less biased coverage than you do on Venezuela. I mean, uniformly, the mainstream media, but then even things, you know, online sites that supposedly have alternative coverage, like The Daily Beast and BuzzFeed, have terribly one-sided coverage on the issue of Venezuela. Obviously, there's no agreement, there can't be a media-wide conspiracy to have anti-Venezuela coverage, but it certainly seems that way. What is keeping all of these media outlets in line?
Well, I think there's a very strong effort and a very strong posture on the part of the Venezuelan opposition. They have learned the lesson very well from the Cuban-American relationships in Miami and South Florida. So they know how to target the media. They know how to essentially help create a public opinion. And they've done that very strongly. Plus, there's other factors, I think, also. It's simply the lack of knowledge that existed about Venezuela and the U.S. Before Hugo Chavez comes the power, and I always say this, and whenever I give a talk about Venezuela, is what did you really know about Venezuela besides the fact that it had oil, the fact that it may have won some Miss Universe contest, and it had a handful of baseball players? That's all the U.S. population really knew about Venezuela. And it's ironic then, all of a sudden, from that point of departure to all of a sudden, we have dozens and dozens of experts on Venezuela, some of which have never even traveled to the country, let alone actually done work or research about the country or know its history, all of a sudden becoming experts on the country, which is really a sort of creates this position in order to be able to manipulate public opinion. But let me suggest that there's also a difference here between how they report Bolivia and Ecuador, much in the same way. In fact, we've seen very much evidence of, when Hugo Chavez was alive, of calling Chavez, Morales, and Correa the three amigos, including Lula in there, or including Cristina Kirchner in there, or the Pirates of the Caribbean, or some other version of that. So that there's been an ongoing issue in terms of when the left takes power, somehow that rubs some people in the U.S. the wrong way, particularly in terms of the pseudo-left, the social democratic left in the U.S. I find that ironic, the coverage that they actually provided of El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Honduras when they were active guerrilla movements was actually much more balanced than it is in terms of when that left actually comes to power. So it's all right to be an insurgent force in Central America facing a dictatorship, but it's not all right to sort of alter the balance of power in the region and alter how the U.S. can actually function in the area.
Well, Miguel, setting aside for a moment the coup attempts and the U.S. media coverage and their mocking of Maduro, how do you objectively assess his presidency so far? I mean, it's tough to, follow and act like Chavez.
It's very difficult. He cannot be Chavez. Chavez was an organic leader that came out of the population, that had a historical generational experience, and any effort on his part to try to imitate or be Chavez would simply be wrong. I think he faces much more difficult conditions. I think much of what he faces is in part the legacy of Hugo Chavez. There were many issues here that the Chavez government did not fully address, particularly because you had high oil prices, and that is the very nature of the dependence of the economy on oil. So that if you wanted to be very critical, you have to say that has to be an issue that wasn't fully addressed by Chavez, although there were many efforts at trying to find alternative forms of development. There has to be greater accountability. There has to be greater transparency. They have to streamline the government. They have to really fundamentally deal with the multiple exchange rates. You can't have a exchange rate at 192 on the alternative market and then pretend that you can have it at 6. They began to address that. As I said earlier, they now have a different exchange rate. But again, all those issues, they were slow to react to all those issues in many ways because many Venezuelans consider oil to be their birthright. They can't have gasoline at 1 cent a gallon. That's simply impossible. That's a $12 billion subsidy that the government has to provide for the population. And 30% of that is going out to Colombia and to Brazil as contraband. The same thing with subsidized food products, which are subsidized to protect the Venezuelan population, but a significant amount of that is finding its way to Colombia and to Brazil, where it's sold on the free market, and therefore there's scarcities in Venezuela. So I think the government has been slow to respond to that. They really need to address the economy, and that's really the challenge that they face.
Finally, Miguel, and briefly, where do you turn to for Venezuela news when you're not traveling there yourself?
I look at newspapers in Venezuela, Últimas Noticias. I read broadly. I try to. You have to read Spanish, unfortunately,
right.
But you have to be able to read alternative papers in Venezuela and follow what the actual news is and have some historical background of the country in order to be able to make sense of it all. Because otherwise, if we simply follow what's happening here, the news, the way it's reported here, serves to mock, and it does a disservice to the North American population because they really don't understand the changes that are taking place in Latin America. And why the reporting in that fashion really sort of creates a greater bifurcation and a greater lack of knowledge about the changes taking place in Latin America today.
And I find that VenezuelaAnalysis.com, Telesur English, and RT are some of the good sources in the English language media on this.
No doubt. For an English-speaking audience, I would recommend Venezuela Analysis. I would recommend Telesur in English and other sources you mentioned.
Miguel, I want to thank you so much for your wide-ranging analysis on this issue, and best of luck. We'll surely have you back on.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
My guest, Ms. Miguel Tinker Salas, is a professor of Latin American history and Chicano Latino studies at Pomona College in Claremont, California. He's written several books, including The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Citizenship in Venezuela, Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know. He's also co-edited Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, and The Decline of an Exceptional Democracy. This is Uprising. Bipasha Shom is our senior producer. Anna Buss is our assistant producer. Christian Beck is our production assistant. Jennifer McMartin is our research intern. Alexander Hobbs is our technical director. Federico Garcia and Jonathan Alexander are our audio engineers. Annie Mendoza is our social media coordinator. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you tomorrow.